The Breakfast Huddle replay from Money FM 89.3.
For now, it's time for our Sustainable Singapore series here on The Breakfast Huddle. Last month, we had the annual United Nations Climate Change Conference, also known as COP25. It closed in a bit of disappointment over in Madrid after 2 weeks spent trying to hash out a deal, and it even overran by 2 days.
Yeah, well, maybe everyone was just on a lag because they had to change it from Santiago to Madrid.
Then there's that, right?
Everybody had to change their plans. Anyway, countries did fail to agree on many of the hoped four outcomes. That includes rules to set up a global carbon trading system and a system to channel new finance to countries facing the impact of climate change.
Well, our next two guests believe that when it comes to saving the planet, it's important for people to understand the process of international climate negotiations.
Yeah, every year they represent the National University of Singapore at the annual COP meetings and have written a policy brief on the outcomes or lack thereof, of the Madrid Climate Conference.
Well, in the studio with us to share more about this is Melissa Low, Research Fellow at Energy Studies Institute at NUS. Melissa, good morning.
Good morning, Elliot. Good morning.
Manisha,
sorry.
And joining Melissa is Eric B., Research Assistant at NUS's Asia Pacific Center for Environmental Law. Eric, good morning.
Morning, and thanks for having us.
Good to see you both. So, Melissa, let's begin with you. You've been observing negotiations at this annual United Nations Climate Conference scene for a decade now. How has the narrative changed from what you've observed?
Well, yeah, so my first COP was COP15 in Copenhagen, and, you know, maybe listeners may know how that went. Actually, it also ended in failure. Mm. So maybe at the 10-year mark, it was sort of, revisiting some of those feelings. But over the last 10 years, I feel that the COP and countries have made quite a lot of progress over the years. We know that Paris in COP21 back in 2015 managed to ink out a landmark agreement by which all countries will now have to commit to pledges. So previously, under the Kyoto Protocol that was agreed in 1997, it was only required for 37 developed countries. So I think we've come some way. Definitely this year, there's a lot of disappointment because of the huge urgency that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they had released three reports on land, cryosphere, and the 1.5 degrees, as well as, you know, global climate protests. So a huge disappointment because countries seem to have failed. But what people kind of forget is that last year in Katowice in Poland, there was a huge bulk of issues that was agreed. So this year really felt like a low in the last 10 years because there was nothing, you know, that really pushed through. So everything will be saved for Glasgow this year.
Mm. Actually, Melissa, since we are here to talk about understanding climate negotiations, I was at the UNHQ in New York 2 weeks ago, and I was told by our guides that at the end of the day, really, when everyone gathers at this General Assembly, it's a lot of discussions happening. It's 15-minute presentations, and it still needs to be ratified by the various governments. That's a big stumbling block, or for a better lack of choice of words, it's a bit of a stumbling block.
Yeah, so the UN works on consensus.
Sure.
So that means that all countries who are party to whichever agreement, in this case, it would be to the convention, to the Kyoto Protocol, as well as to the Paris Agreement. So there's three agreements, actually, that countries need to come to some form of agreement on. And even if one country decides they're not interested or not keen for whatever reason, then there are basically blockages to that consensus. And as we know, there are certain parties in the world and certain countries in the world that are not party to particular agreements. For instance, the US is not a party to the Kyoto Protocol. And they've also recently announced that they would be withdrawing a year from the 4th of November. Yeah. So in 2020, this year, 4th of November, they will officially cease to be a part of the Paris Agreement. So again, it comes down to countries' processes, as you say, but also it's a matter of negotiation, right? So parties have to come to some kind of agreement, otherwise things won't go through.
Eric, any thoughts on this to share?
Thanks for asking. So I think the first thing you have to remember in international law and relations is that every country is sovereign and every country has the right to decide on what policies they want to adopt, and that includes how they relate to each other at international level. So a lot of it has to be consensual, and every country has to try to find means and ways to try to get along with each other. So one of the more commonly heard terms at the UNFCCC is landing zone. So landing zones is a way of saying that we have to find a compromise that every country is comfortable with, And when you're talking about 190 over parties and growing, this is really a mammoth task. You would see that all the different subcommittee chairs, a lot of them will come out of the conference looking a lot more weary than they did going in. It's a very common process. Some committee chairs have actually put up reflection notes going into the conference saying that we should try to find compromises. We should not be sticking on old points. We should be constantly talking to each other, trying to make more progress. It's a very incremental process, and you shouldn't expect to see great breakthroughs every year like you saw in Paris in 2015. Sometimes these things really take a very long time.
Right.
And the problem is that next year in 2020, we have to have a complete set of rules going in so that we can actually implement the political agreement of that was put down in the Paris Agreement, the various things we want to do, like the 1.5 degree goal. How are we going to get there? The Paris Agreement itself doesn't say how. So all these rules are the means and ways in which we set up the different mechanisms, including the market mechanism, which I think your listeners will be most interested about. How do we implement these rules in order to create this system? So that, hopefully by end of this year, we'll have a complete rulebook.
Okay. Yeah, but Eric, I mean, just jumping in on that, you sort of alluded to the point that, you know, it's not a quick process sort of coming up with these rules and regulation around these rules. But the issue is that, I mean, this week, we had these figures from on the world's oceans.
Yes.
You know, from the Chinese Academy of Science, that massive project, a global project. I mean, it seems irrefutable. And when you talk about the accelerating pace of global warming, the, what is it, 3.6 billion atom bombs worth of energy that we've put into the ocean. You hear figures like that and you worry and you say, come on, we've got to move faster. So, you know, what does this lack of solid outcomes from Madrid, for example, mean for us in this context?
All right, thanks for that question. So, to put it in context, I saw Greta Thunberg's Twitter last night. She said that that number would be the equivalent of turning on 100 microwave ovens every night for 365 days a year. So that tells you this amount of heating that's going into the oceans based on global warming alone. So what does this mean for us? It does mean that it's not just states who have to take action. If you go into a UN Anthropocene negotiation, you'll see that businesses, the environmental NGOs, the youth, researchers, they're all observing the negotiations. Some of them do take part in sideline conversations with the state parties. To clarify, the researchers, we don't. But there are other NGOs that do that. We do see that happening. And they are all part of negotiations. Greta Thunberg herself was at the UN Anthropocene last year and the year before, and I expect she'll be there again this year. And so a lot of these NGOs, they are at the sidelines, but they are trying to create a momentum for all these states to try to reach higher. And as what the UN Secretary General asked for at the COP24 conference, ambition, 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 and more ambition. We hope that this will be the outcome in COP26 in Glasgow this year. We can only wait to see what this year's nationally determined contributions are submitted by every country, including Singapore, which has undertaken to update its NDC this year. So we have to see whether all these figures lead to a reduction in the total carbon emissions as compared to the 2015 intended NDCs. We've just got to see that.
Just a quick one on this, and since you brought up ambition, NUS delegates involved in several side events throughout the COP25. Melissa, any chance you could tell us what they were up to?
Yeah, so thanks so much. So Eric and I, actually, we helped organise a number of side events at the COP25. This is the first time we did this. So we've been going for 10 years, but this is the first time that we organised our own selves around an issue, which is capacity building. And this is what, obviously, the universities are here for, right? To build capacity among students and staff to take the negotiations on climate change seriously so that we have the language, the vocabulary to discuss these issues with the general public and with people who matter in this process. So we were very fortunate to have gotten a slot. This is competitive, right?
Yeah.
So everybody in the world wants slot to present issues, and we presented on one of the workshops that we've been doing the last 2 years on climate change negotiations. So we're really happy to do that.
Let's talk about switching from fossil fuels to renewables. It's a little bit more than just having the willpower. It does require money. It requires capital. guys, in your opinion, do you think finance ministries around the world are committed enough to implementing climate finance into their domestic economic policies? And if you have an example of a country that's doing a good job at it, that would be helpful. Perhaps, Eric, this might be up your alley.
Yeah, when it comes to finance, yes, finance ministries, they do have a role in catalyzing the investments in renewable energy. So in terms of countries which are doing the most to do finance transition to renewable energies, I think the European Union in general, most of the member states are quite ahead of the times. We see that's where most of the momentum is. We have the currently largest carbon market, which is the European Union Emissions Trading Scheme in the EU, obviously, and I think that's where the momentum is right now. But we also we should not overlook the role of private sector investments as well as the role of multilateral development banks as well. So there are many ways to finance a transition to renewable energy, and we also see that just market forces alone, the solar panels, they are getting cheaper by the day.
Yeah.
Storage is getting cheaper by the day as well. We are also seeing developments in terms of electric vehicles. So a lot of it just has to do with what makes sense for both the economy and the environment. Sometimes these two do not have to conflict. Sometimes they go hand in hand.
Tech can be the answer. Melissa, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, so in Madrid, actually, 50 finance ministers had committed to a plan and to mainstream climate finance into their own ministry. So I think that was a great sort of showcase of commitment. Although, I mean, I think it remains to be seen whether it actually happened, because you know how politics is, and you know, people can lose their jobs pretty quickly if an election comes around. But yeah, I think in general, 2020 will be a really important year for climate finance, because the Green Climate Fund is actually supposed to be, or filled up, as it were, with US $100 billion every year by 2020. And I think, unfortunately, we're only at $10 billion committed at this point in time. But I think there are other indications that climate finance is not just from this one fund alone. There are other flows of finance as well that we need to take into account. And I think other estimates put it at US $70 billion. So I think it depends what methodologies you're using. But in general, I think there are finance flows that are going around. We just need to make sure that people and whoever it is that's using these funds and committing these funds are accountable to that money.
Melissa, just shifting the conversation slightly away from finance now, really interesting story that goes back a little bit. An environmental group in Holland successfully suing to force the Dutch government to cut the nation's greenhouse gas emissions by 25% from 1990 levels by the end of 2020. They argued that the Netherlands' current commitments were insufficient and violated human rights. I mean, this is one example of a few. Do you think we'll begin to see more cases like this with citizens coming to their government basically saying, we're going to sue you because you haven't done enough?
Well, I would like to say, because I've been observing this FCCC process for a long time, I would like to say that the international governance mechanism works, but clearly this case from Holland shows that people are not really happy with this. Actually, I would like to defer to Eric, because he's a lawyer by training, obviously.
Okay.
And, you know, he can talk to litigation a little bit more and whether or not we will see more of these cases.
Yeah, thanks. So I think when we talk about Europe, they have a very different political and legal background from us. They have something called the European Convention on Human Rights. So if I remember correctly, that case, Agenda, the case name is called Agenda versus the Netherlands government. If I'm not wrong, part of the arguments in there were made based on this European Convention on Human Rights, and as well as the fact that Netherlands is a member of the European Union, which has a group target across all its 27 member states, leaving aside the UK, to reduce emissions by a certain amount by 2030 and by 2050. So the Netherlands was, after looking at the documents submitted by both parties in the Supreme Court of Netherlands, it was decided that the Netherlands was not playing enough of its part to achieve the EU's own group targets. So that's a slightly different conversation we're having in Europe. In this part of the world, we don't have such a convention. We don't have a big group goal in the same way as the European Union does. So I think there are different ways to get what you want to get. And maybe in this part of the world, it won't be through litigation. It might be through more capacity building with state officials and the NGOs and other players.
But very briefly, if you wouldn't mind, if you have countries signing up to any sort of protocol, whether it's Kyoto Protocol or the next one or whatever happens in Glasgow, will that actually give citizens leverage to say, I can hold you to account now? And could you actually see cases come out of that if governments are not meeting those targets?
Well, it will really depend on the national legal systems that you have in place. So I wouldn't be able to discuss what is applicable in other countries.
Sure.
Just in Singapore alone, I think the way most environmental advocates are going about this is we are continuously communicating with the government what is the future we'd like to see, as the Rio Declaration 1992 put it, the future we'd like to see and how we can achieve these goals together, rather, and we would rather do it in a more conversational fashion, a more communal fashion, and a less we want to reduce the amount of conflicts we have, and we want to try to reach these goals together if we can, because I think just as we have to have consensus in the international community, in the local community, it's best to have the same kind of consensus, even if it does seem to take a bit more time, but it will be a more sustainable and a more durable pathway than, say, litigation, if you ask me.
We've been speaking this morning with Melissa Low, Research Fellow at Energy Studies Institute at NUS, as well as Eric B., Research Assistant at NUS's Asia Pacific Center for Environmental Law. Guys, thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you.
The Breakfast Huddle's Sustainable Singapore series is written and produced by Rianne Lovell-Bolin.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.